This morning's chapter is Micah, chapter 6. We'll have a reading of 8 verses, Brother Russell. Hear ye now what the Lord saith. Arise, contend thou before the mountains, and let the hills hear thy voice. Hear ye, O mountains, the Lord's controversy, and ye strong foundations of the earth. For the Lord hath a controversy with his people, and he will plead with Israel. O my people, what have I done unto thee, and wherein have I wearied thee? Testify against me. For I brought thee up out of the land of Egypt, and redeemed thee out of the house of servants. And I sent before thee Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. O my people, remember now what Balak, king of Moab, consulted, and what Balaam the son of Beor answered him from Shittim unto Gilgal, that ye may know the righteousness of the Lord. Wherewith shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves of a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams or with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He hath shewed thee, O man, what is good, and what doth the Lord require of thee, but to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God.
All right. Thank you. The reason we wanted such an extensive reading is there's this scripture that is so well known, what doth the Lord require of thee? And there's a philosophical or a moral lesson here that I think can be lost sight of if you just zero in on that quotation. But now we go back to verse 1. Now, those that have been have studied ahead, is there anyone with regard to these verses 1 through 8, would like to make a comment on anything before we sort of disrupt individual thinking? Of those verses that have been read. Because we'd like to present a different perspective that sometimes as Bible students we get lost with regard to sometimes the semantics. As I recall, with regard to the book of Micah, remember in earlier chapters, on a few occasions, he addressed his criticism to judges, to the princes, and so forth, and in several, and the priests, and castigated them. But not individuals, but the priesthood, the princes, and the king by inference and so forth, and he's has done these things. And then, in one instance at least, he comes down to the level of the people and criticizes the people. I'm not going into the detail because we've already studied that, but this is the way he proceeded in his message. And the message was strong, and there were some sweet things put in that ultimately in the future there would be, the Lord would remember and have mercy on his people. But now we come to this chapter, and what is interesting here is that the Lord has him use a different technique, a different procedure. Now, normally when we would read this as Bible students, and when he would be saying, hear ye, O mountains, the Lord's controversy, and the strong foundations of the earth, and so forth, we would be going in, well, a mountain is an autocratic government, an island is a democratic government, and things like this, which would be true in certain other passages, because the Bible does make a distinction between dictatorship, autocratic power, as well as republican or a democratic type of government. But if you do that here, I think we will lose something at it. Now, in this case, he is instructed to dramatize this. Now, first thing, in order to get this message over inferentially, the best time to get a single message to the largest audience possible would be at one of the feast days. It doesn't say anything about that. Because here on certain feast days, you would have at least 1 million people in the area of the temple. And in pronouncing a message, it would spread out by word of mouth and reach like the nation. Because these people, when they go back, they would say what had happened on this occasion. So he's instructed to face the mountains which surround in the temple area. You have the Mount of Olives and other olives. And he's saying, he stresses this loud, and he must have had a very powerful voice to be heard. It's very hard to speak outdoors. I don't know if you've had that. I was successful to a certain limit because when I really raised my voice, it could be heard for quite a distance. But I could see with others, it was very difficult to address any number of people outdoors. Now, in this, he addresses the mountains, literally, and he's talking to them, and he's castigating them, and he may have even been raising his fist in anger as representative of God, as representing the Lord, how what he feels about this matter. And so he has a matter of contention with them, and he's addressing it, and he's calling the mountains as though it were the nations, and really that's what it represents. But now they're caught off guard. Had he done this to them as people, criticizing the princes and so forth, some would be immediately turned off. They would, they wouldn't want to hear it and so forth, and they in anger and some. But this being done in such a fashion where he's speaking to a neutral area, and he's speaking to these inanimate mountains and the surrounding terrain, which is inanimate, and addressing them, and it's really getting the message to the people far more effectively than had he turned to them and criticized them from a balcony or wherever it might be. And so in doing this, he tells about the mountains and the foundations of the earth and that the Lord has this controversy with his people and he will plead with Israel, but he's not talking down to them, he's talking to the mountain that, and they know right away that that mountain represents the kingdom. They know that the foundations represent the foundations of government, the courts, and so forth. They don't have to be explained. It's self-explanatory when he's doing this addressing in this fashion. And then he begins to plead with the mountains, not them, see. And he says, haven't I done this for you? Some of these statements, some of these verses can be put in question form, not just a simple statement. Haven't I done this for you when you were in Egypt and did that? Did I do something wrong when I did that? Remember about Balaam and Balak? Here Balaam was a heathen king, as it were, and he wanted my people to be cursed, and Balaam came on the scene as a prophet, and here Balaam was frustrated, and instead of cursing the people, it was turned into a blessing, a prophetic blessing about their coming Messiah and so forth. And he says, these are some things, and he leads them up to Jordan, because he tells from Shittim to Gilgal. Now, these are not in the same place. He's telling about how he dealt with them real up to the borderline of Israel. And even at that time, they went over Jordan dry shod like they did from Egypt. But he's not mentioning that. They inferentially are led to fill in that gap because in the nature in which this is being dramatized. And he says, as when he does this, we believe now, this is conjecture, but now when he's speaking this, Micah, he's speaking as though he's the Lord. Haven't I done this? Haven't I done that? Well, Micah didn't do it, but he's acting the part of God. Then what he does, he changes around. And now he's the people, just the opposite. And he may even change his voice. You know, there are people who do this. Some people imitate a male and a female. There are some actors who go on a stage and they enact six or seven different people and there's nobody around, and just by their voice, by their inflection, they are different characters. And they don't say, I'm now this and I'm now that. They're so clever in doing it that you know that they're impersonating another individual, and they carry on even a play. And all they're doing is standing in front with no backdrop and by the power of words. And so we feel that the prophet himself, that the Lord enabled him to speak very powerfully and dramatically to this inanimate terrain as though it were God pleading with his people. And then he affects the sinful nation. He now is in a completely different mode. And then when it comes to verse 6, here's where the situation changes. And he says, wherewith shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves of a year? They're looking for help. Here he's affecting as though he is representative of the people who have sinned and who recognize that they have sinned. And they are now wanting to know what can we do for such enormous guilt that the prophet previously had poured on them as a people, what he had the favors of. They feel, what shall I do? No. They know instinctively that isn't sufficient to offer that. And even if it goes so far, would the Lord be pleased with even thousands of rams or 10,000 rivers of oil? That is not, even that doesn't erase that guilt. This is something that's deep. And notice too, is this the account where he brings in about Ahab?
No,
yeah, he doesn't.
Verse 16.
That'll come in later. Ahead. All right. So they sense this, that not the one sin offering or burnt offering or whatever it might be would pacify the Lord, and even 1,000, it's something that is more needful. Shall I give my firstborn son? Because that was done by some. Even one of the kings of Israel offered his firstborn son as a sacrifice to Baal. Would that do it? No, they feel. So here he's assuming a sinner who is penitent, and he realized, what can I do placate my God who has done so much for me, and I've have walked so perversely? And then this is what leads to what he has shewed thee, O man, what is good, and what the Lord require of thee, but to do justly. In other words, the requirement that the Lord was asking his people was a reasonable sacrifice. Just like Paul says to the Christian, present your bodies a reasonable, a living sacrifice. But he's trying to, it's a reasonable thing.
Service.
And so from this standpoint, the Lord is now, he turns around and assumes that he's the Lord, and he's answering this petition. What can I do to amend what I've done wrong? And then the Lord says, all that's needed is to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with thy God. Now, this applies to everybody who wants to serve, not just the saints, not only the truly, but anybody who wants to please God. This would be a basic requirement on whatever plane, to walk humbly, love mercy, do justly, even with the, and now this is addressed to the nation, that what God's required, that it's simple. It's not some complicated thing. All he wants is obedience, to obey him. Now, of course, there are other things involved, which we will get subsequently when we go to following verses. So from that standpoint, I think it gives more feeling of the effectiveness of Micah, that there's one verse somewhere that states that those who have wisdom, those who are inclined to respond to this type of message, that it would get over to them and would be effectual. But, of course, that would be a minority. It would be a minority in the final. He that hath an ear to hear, let him hear. And that's in here somewhere, I forget which verse, but not expressly stated in that particular fashion. So that's why we read the whole thing, to show that this is introducing a simple requirement instead of all these sacrifices of wealth and means and so. They cannot cleanse sins. Yes?
This occurred back in Micah's day, but is there a lesson for the future that in regard to the holy remnant, that a strong message would be given to the nation showing their weakness and sins and need of repentance?
Yes, by extrapolation, that's true. That would be, I would think that would be the responsible message to be given. You have something like that with John the Baptist. When the soldiers came to him and the people came to him, what should we do? When he told them about that would be this baptism of fire and so forth, how the Lord would judge Israel, the people responded. Some came up to John for advice, and he told, be satisfied with your wages, don't do violence to any man. He gave them some practical, simple advice as to what to do, something they could grab a hold of rather than just nebulous terms. Yes. And this would be true with regard to Israel in the future. Yes, that was, we believe, a proper...
With that saying?
Yes.
That would be part of the work of the ancient worthy, would it not?
Well, in fact, yes, that in the... Because this is a basic requirement through the, especially in the kingdom age. And people are always worried about what they're going to give up and not realize how they've been blessed with certain privileges, blessings. But I think now when we go to succeeding verses from this standpoint, we begin to see he begins to explain this, I don't know how to express it, to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly before thy God. The subsequent verses explain what is stated in those few words. How to do justly. How do you do justice? And then he gives several illustrations of malpractice that now exists in among the people. He says, this is what's being done. And it means stop. Stop this other habit that you've been, of greed, selfishness that you've been doing. And he brings it right down to practical terms, just like John the Baptist did. That could be understood and not just be a slogan. Slogans are easy to utter, but as to what they really mean, is that it can be quite a different thing. If there's no question or comment on those verses, we would proceed then on a verse-by-verse procedure from verse 9. But let us have a reading, Sister Dawn, of four verses. That's through 12.
The Lord's voice crieth unto the city, and the man of wisdom shall see thy name. Hear ye the rod, and who hath appointed it? Are there yet the treasures of wickedness in the house of the wicked, and the scant measure that is abominable? Shall I count them pure with the wicked balances, and with the bag of deceitful weights? For the rich men are full of violence, and the inhabitants have spoken lies, and their tongue is deceitful in their mouth.
All right. Now, verse 9. The Lord's voice crieth unto the city, and the word the man of is, of course, applied, and wisdom, that he that hath wisdom, he that hath an ear to hear, this is the verse that would imply that the one, and one that says, hear the rod, what's that?
The rod is divine authority and control.
All right. Any other way of expressing that? The rod of instruction, the rod of discipline. The rod has several thoughts, but basically they're all along the same line, that the rod is, this is, sometimes you need the, like the child needs a spanking, it needs instruction and discipline in order to know, to be confirmed in righteousness. And who hath appointed it? Some people don't understand the Lord's providence. The children of Israel wandered in the wilderness. It was a wilderness wandering. And that's why many of the children of Israel murmured and complained. They did not see that their experiences were for their benefit and that the Lord was teaching his people through providence and discipline. And those of the people who could perceive God's hand in this would benefit. But others, they just see things as calamities, of lacks, of wants, and they don't see in those experiences the lesson that they were intended to instruct the ones that were being disciplined. So, and that's why Paul, in his discipline, in his explanation in the New Testament, we don't want to be one like a shadow boxer, all motion and punching around. You have to concentrate. You have to concentrate on a goal. And our goal is to make our calling and election sure. Boiled down to simple facts is we want to inherit the prize. We want to be with Jesus. We'd like to have all these things that the Lord's Word promises. But if you don't keep your focus of attention along that line, you can get sidetracked by all kinds of diversions. And even if they're innocuous, the diversion, say, let's say it seems to be legitimate, nothing wrong with it and so forth, it's a distraction from the main. And so the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness, where Moses, with all these experiences, he could see through them what they were designed to do and so forth. And when he gives his wonderful sermon, several chapters in Deuteronomy, it's filled or fraught with meaning because he saw the lessons being taught where the majority of the people were completely oblivious to the Lord's hand in their development and experiences. So he's saying here that the man who has wisdom, they shall see thy name, that is the Lord's hand in the providence that occur. Verse 10. What's this? Are there yet the treasures of wickedness in the house of the wicked, and the scant measure that is abominable? What about this?
Referring to business practices.
All right.
The latter
part. All right. Yes.
Yeah. It says, am I still to forget, O wicked house, your ill-gotten treasures? And the shore Ephraim, which is accursed.
All right. The scant measures, yes. That. This is sort of like a rhetorical question. are there yet the treasures of wickedness in the house of the wicked? Well, that's what you make of it. Those that have been performing these practices, if they do not forsake them, it still exists. In spite of instruction, in spite of what the prophet has done, there are those that will not change their ways or their habits. Where those that have understanding and desire to serve the Lord will receive instruction. Now this about the house of the wicked, the scant measure. What is the scant measure now? You read it in there.
The ephah, the short ephah.
All right. And that reminds you of that other scripture.
Amos
9? 8. Amos 8. When will the new moon be gone and the Sabbath be over? This is in the kingdom age. There are some who in their heart so love their former position of honor, prestige, wealth, power, that they're waiting for the kingdom age to end so they go back to the former method. And if a person, say, is very capable, there are some people who are born leaders. They have the ability to lead. That you could take away their wealth and start from scratch and they'd earn a fortune again. And you take that away and they earn it again. There are many millionaires who have been wiped out completely, but they have that ability that even when they start from scratch, before long, they can climb back up the ladder. Not all millionaires by no means, but there are certain ones that have this capability. They are superior in their field, whether it's finance or whatever field it might be. They excel in it just because by nature they're endowed with certain elements that make them superior, at least in that field. And here, this class, they're waiting for this restraint to be removed. And to make the ephah, then, the ephah would be the what you call is the measure. The matter is the quantity. They make the quantity small. And in Amos it says, and they jack up the price. They not only make the ephah small, but they jack up the price so you get double gain. Both ways. You defraud and then you tax the individual with the...
Yes. Verse 5 in Amos.
All right. Read it then if you want to, please.
When will the new moon be gone, that we may sell grain, and the Sabbath, that we may set forth wheat, making the ephah small and the shekel great, and falsifying the balances by deceit?
Right. In the old days, when you went to the store, it was like a lot different than today. You go to the supermarket, and everything has got a label on it. The price per pound, the weight, it's 1 pound, 3 ounces, price per pound is so-and-so, and then they get the cost. They get three things on the label that the government requires this in the sales. But in the old days, when you go to the butcher, you depend on the personality of the storekeeper. And you'd ask for a pound of butter or a pound of beans. They have big barrels. You didn't have these free package things. These things were done with scoops and with for liquid, certain containers. And they might be putting it on the scale and putting their finger on it at the same time and pressing it down without you knowing it, because they are behind a counter. And you're watching the scale to make sure the way, and he's pressing it with his finger. So that in principle is falsifying. You're falsifying the weight, and you're charging the price for something that isn't as heavy as it's supposed to be. And some manipulate the scale. They know if you turn certain screws or something on the machine, that it gives a falsified measurement. And, of course, the merchant makes sure that it's in his favor, not in the favor of the customer. And so they falsify the scale. Or they have, the old time, you had this a balance. And you put a weight on one side that says 3-4 ounces, a pound, and that's put on the one side of the scale, and the commodity is put on the other side of the scale. Now, everything depends on that weight, whether it's a true weight. When you press 1 pound down here, and there's 1 pound on this weight you put on, that it should balance. But supposing they change these counterweights, and they're false. Instead of being a pound, it might be 14 ounces or 12 ounces. And you think, you're looking at the scale, and you think everything is what they put the weight on, and that's it. But the customer is being defrauded. And so in the old days, this was done. This was done by people who were so interested in profit-making that they actually practiced thievery to the public. Where the laws now of the country are, they try to eliminate this as far as possible to give a fair deal to the public. But even then, you have to send inspectors around every once in a while to make sure that when they put the label on, that the label is correct today.
Well, they have moisture in there, too.
Yeah. So these practices are, so to do justly, this is what you give a even measurement. You give a just weight, a just measure, a just quantity, a just price. That's to do justice in the commercial world, and of course with your friends and with your neighbors. And this 11th verse.
Can you just explain it?
Yeah. Shall I count them pure with the wicked balances? And with the bag of deceitful weights, isn't this something you're pulling out from the bag, as it were? You know that you can't go too much overboard, or you'll be spotted as being crooked. So they have to select the right weight to defraud the customer just enough so that they don't, they're guileless, that they don't realize they're being short-handed. And so they're taking out of the bag of deceit, they take out that which is appropriate, what they feel. And sometimes people apprise the customer by the look of the customer. They see, is this fellow intelligent? Is he with it? And sometimes with older people, the cashier tries to change the bill in giving the change, and they know that people, when they're older, are a little slower, and they give them instead of a $5 bill, they give them a $1 bill. In the meantime, they have $4 to their benefit that they've gotten from the one customer. So these things are done. But we, normally today, there's more fear in the sense that they don't know, but they're being spotted with a camera or something. And if it's done too repetitively, the report will get back to the management. And so they're... It's done still, but it's done with only on a certain occasion, not systematic. But in other businesses, we're reading in the newspaper how this is being done. Banks are being defrauded by false checks that accounts that, and people think they have in their accounts such a money, but somebody in the bank has been siphoning off the money and using it for their own benefit. So this is done today. Verse 12. For the rich men thereof are full of violence. The inhabitants thereof have spoken lies, and their tongue is deceitful in their mouth. Any comments on this?
The Good News Bible says, your rich men exploit the poor, and all of you are liars.
Yeah, what it says, and the inhabitants, instead of all of you, but that.
And their tongues speak deceitfully. What a mess.
So he's trying to say, what doth the Lord require of thee, but to do justly? And now, this is the unjust procedure that has to be rectified. We didn't read 13, did we?
No.
Let us read next 13 and 14, please.
Therefore also will I make thee sick in smiting thee, in making thee desolate because of thy sins. Thou shalt eat, but not be satisfied, and thy casting down shall be in the midst of thee. And thou shalt take hold, but shalt not deliver, and that which thou deliverest will I give up to the sword.
Wow.
One more.
Thou shalt sow, but thou shalt not reap. Thou shalt tread the olives, but thou shalt not anoint thee with oil, and sweet wine, but shalt not drink wine.
Right. Any comments on verse 13 about the sickness in smiting?
He's referring to the future captivity that was right. Imminent, that would be punishment.
All right. It would show the justness of the, and the necessity for a national discipline. Because if all the people are like this, that means that a national calamity is necessary because the populace as a whole are guilty. There are, of course, some that are not, but...
In general, the Deuteronomy that Moses predicted, given all the law, if you do not obey, something happened in the 28:38. Thou shalt carry much seed out into the field, and shalt gather but little in, for the locusts shall consume it. So that should be prophesied.
Well, Moses is telling them that. Being their God's people, and obedience was rewarded as far as natural Israel is concerned with natural rewards, natural blessings. They would, in bearing children, have many children, and in planting seed, they would have a big crop if they obeyed him. If they disobeyed him, there would be a leanness that would be. And this would be a general procedure of the experience of Israel. And then they were brought into captivity several times under the judges. They'd have a nice judge who would and then he'd die, and somebody else come in that isn't quite as good. Or they'd go into captivity, various captivities during the period of judges. All this was disciplinary. But of course, here in Micah, it's predicting a specific future captivity that was imminent on the nation, particularly on the 10-tribe kingdom, which was about to occur, because he's speaking now in the days in which the 10-tribe kingdom came to an end, when Micah was prophesying. Let's read the next verse.
For the statutes of Omri are kept, and all the works of the house of Ahab, and that ye walk in their counsel, that I should make thee a desolation, and the inhabitants thereof, and hissing. Therefore ye shall bear the reproach of my people.
Who was Omri?
The king of Israel.
All right, here's the king. He also was?
Wicked king.
He was a very wicked king, yes. One of the worst, yes.
Yeah, I just had, it's 1 Kings 16:25-26, about Omri.
All right, read it.
But Omri wrought evil in the eyes of the Lord, and did worse than all that were before him. For he walked in the way, in all the way, of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, and his sin wherewith he made Israel to sin, to provoke the Lord God of Israel to anger with their vanities.
This 31 and 32, I think, also.
And it came to pass, or actually, and Ahab the son of Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord above all that were before him, and it came to pass, as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, that he took to wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Zidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him, and he reared up an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he had built in Samaria.
All right. What we were trying to elicit information was the fact that Omri was the father of Ahab. Omri was the father. And then it says Omri was the up to that point in time was the most wicked of all that preceded him. So we can see that the traits of Ahab, of his father, rubbed off on him.
The dogs, he drank Ahab's blood, didn't they?
Yeah, well, that's the punishment, the retribution that was to come, that Elijah predicted.
That's in verse 29, too, Ahab, the son of Omri.
Then the Jeroboam that's spoken of there is?
The one who broke away, made the separation after King Solomon's death.
All right. The original division of the 12 tribes into a 10-tribe kingdom and the 2-tribe kingdom, Jeroboam led a rebellion that resulted in the 10-tribe kingdom. Well, what was read? What was read? Not in Micah. In Micah, it only mentions two names, I think.
Omri
and Ahab. But this about Jezebel, that's very instructive, that Ahab, in addition to inheriting the weaknesses, sins of his father, he just compounded the problem by marrying this Jezebel outside of Israel, a daughter of the Zidonians, who worshipped Baal, and the result was, because of that marriage, that Ahab built an altar to Baal instead of to Jehovah. That there was this, because of that marriage and placating his wife, and as time went on, of course, she became the dread force, Jezebel, because of her influence. Yes.
Let us think, hopefully this isn't a repetition of an earlier study, but since Isaiah and Micah were contemporary prophets, in the first chapter of Isaiah there's such a strong indictment of all levels of society. Isaiah 1:4-6, "Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corrupted. They have forsaken the Lord. They have provoked the Holy One of Israel unto anger. They are gone away backwards." I'm skipping verse 5. "From the sole of the foot even unto the head, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. They have not been closed, neither bound up, neither mollified with ointment."
Yes. In reading the book of Micah, if you look at the marginal reference, there's very frequent reference to Isaiah because they were contemporaries. And we believe that they both spoke the same theme. And, of course, this is hypothetical, but I think that Isaiah, when he was prophesying, as he became older, had a protege, Micah. That Micah was the protege of Isaiah. And thus you had the two that were so similar in their thinking.
That would have been comforting to Isaiah, too, to have someone, because the nation basically didn't listen to him.
And then God, being the instructor of his people as a parent, was responsible for their correction. And that correction necessitated a national judgment. And that's why it was essential that they go into captivity to impress the lesson of their unworthiness of the favors previously bestowed on them as a people. And they did come to their senses, several in the nation, that we learn of in other, not the minor prophets, but some of the major prophets, Ezekiel and Jeremiah. That the Lord would not forsake his people, but they would be, as it were, a little sanctuary amongst this 10-tribe kingdom who were taken into captivity, that there would be a source of solace and comfort given to them and instruction in their captivity, as later the same thing happened with regard to the 2-tribe kingdom when they were taken into captivity. Well, I think we've finished the chapter here, and this is a good starting point for another lesson and another time, God willing. So we'll close, unless somebody has a comment to make, close